You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
You saw the game-winning play once, but have to replay it three times on the way back to the hotel. Because some moments don't end at the buzzer. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
I saw this app.
I got a hit.
In the new limited series, DTF St. Louis, Jason Bateman, David Harbour, and Linda Cardellini star as three suburbanites who spice up their love lives.
Wow.
Don't miss the new HBO original limited series, DTF St. Louis, premiering March 1st on HBO Max.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Hunting Gear Podcast. I always have to stop and think what podcast I'm recording. Whether I say, oh, it's the Nine Finger Chronicles or it's the How to Hunt Deer or whatever. I just really like podcasting, and I like podcasting about deer, hunting gear and equipment, like entertainment and a little education. I just like it. I like talking about all of it, dude. How about you?
I love it, dude. We're professional bullshitters, right? I just don't know how you manage that many shows all at once, dude. I have a hard enough time just running the one and, getting all that sort of stuff scheduled, but man, like running three of them or something, like, holy smokes, that scheduling has to be a nightmare.
Three, probably soon to be five, to be honest with you. It's like, I always am looking, this is kind of like the crazy part about being self-employed or having an entrepreneur type mind, I guess you would say, like thinking about what I can do or what, you know, what I should do from a business standpoint. And I always am like, hey, I should try to find someone to do this for me. Well, in my head, I'm going, you should do that. Like, I've gotten this far because of me, right? Yeah. You know, and some of the decisions that I made, obviously, as far as the Sportsman's Empire is concerned, there's a collective there of individuals. But as far as like my podcasts, I've gotten to a certain point because what I've done, and I hope that doesn't sound arrogant, but like, I don't know. It just seems like, I forgot to hit pause on something real quick. It just seems like, I don't know, like,
delegating sucks, dude.
Yeah, delegating sucks. I feel like I could, instead of passing something off to someone to try to do, I should just do it and do it better than them, if that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. So totally, dude. Yeah. It's, I don't know, the entrepreneurial wheels, when they're spinning and everything's in sync, it's a beautiful thing. But as soon as one thing falls through the cracks or gets delayed or the timing gets screwed up, everything goes down the drain and it gets hectic fast.
Oh, dude. I feel that. Now, as far as like the entrepreneur spirit, I guess, here's what, like, I don't know. Here's where I always struggle trying to find somebody to look up to. Okay. And that would be like, what's his name? Steve Jobs, right? There was a while there where all these people were just like, Steve Jobs, I love Steve Jobs, you know, creator of the iPhone. They created this cult of worshipers about, but then you kind of realize that he was an asshole.
Yep.
Right. And then even like Michael Jordan, right? Everybody looks up to Michael Jordan, one of the best in the game, but it sounds to me like he was a little bit of an asshole. Right. And so you have all of these great people, and then you find out they're assholes. Like, here's what I really appreciate. I really appreciate people who gain the highest of highs, but are not assholes. They treat people with respect. So that tells you that you don't have to be cutthroat asshole to be successful. You can, like, you can take a path, a different path, right? And you can be kind and generous and thoughtful and understanding instead of being like this some douchebag. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. Well, I think it's, you know, the entrepreneurial side of thing, it like forces you to have humility, right? Yeah. It's like you're forced because you're wearing so many hats and you have to be able to, I mean, shit, you have to be able to get along with people in order to get those people to help you out. Right. I think it's when you start reaching the point of like, okay, I'm no longer an entrepreneur. Now I'm a manager.
Yeah.
That's when everyone's attitude gets a little sour, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Especially when you get to a point like, what's this, for example, the network, right? Mm-hmm. I rely on people who have made me promises to contribute content to the network, right? So let's just say me and you, for example, Pierce, you send me your podcasts. I put them on the Sportsman's Empire, and that's how we distribute your content. Now, if Pierce over there goes, Dan, I don't have an episode this week. Most of the time I'm just like, okay, cool. You know, whatever, that kind of thing happens. But then we start having like 2 weeks go by, 3 weeks go by, and certain people, you know, like just have not made the commitment. I've brought those people on and they have promised me they were going to do content. They've broken their promise. And now I've made promises to advertisers who, you know, who I owe impressions to.
Yeah.
So that, you know, because they've paid me advertising budget, and now I need to make sure I hit those numbers. So going from the point where it's just like building a brand and having fun doing it to a point where you have to manage it and there's accountability involved and all of that stuff, it kind of sucks, to be honest with you, man. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think at that point where a lot of people get burnt out.
Yeah, 100%, dude. I think I don't know if the hunting space is kind of reaching that burnout stage. Oh, I think yeah. We're getting close a little bit in terms of just like the number of guys out there who make a YouTube channel, make an Instagram page, make a whatever. And then it's like, they kind of start to build their own brand. And I'm not bashing guys for doing this by any means, yeah. But I think there's the slices of the pie are getting thinner every single day. Right. And it's kind of just a strange space for hunting to be in right now. I think where you have people who like made their own logo just for going hunting and stuff like that, or like made yep. their own brand or their channel and stuff. And I get that there's, you know, capturing the hunt and that sort of stuff and sharing information is why we all do this kind of stuff. But yep. I think it's a fine line between.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? And then what like the gear and the products are involved, mm-hmm. right? Because obviously yep. how cool would it be to hunt for a living or to do this? But I'll tell you right here, I started everything that I started because I love hunting. Okay.
Yep.
And then you get to a point where, okay, now I need to make money. First off, I'm going to make a little extra money. Oh, awesome. I got a platform to make a little extra money, to the point where you are now, what would I say? You are now, reliant on that income.
Yep.
Right. So now you have to make a whole bunch of different decisions. For example, from a product standpoint, I used to be able to say, hey, dude, I only use products I like, right? I only use products that I trust and that I've vetted and all this stuff. Well, that's not how income works anymore, because in order for me to make money, I have to, and that money goes to, you know, paying my mortgage, putting groceries on the table and making sure I have insurance payments and things like that. You know, all this money, real world shit. I can't say that anymore because I have an accountability towards the business and to the family that wasn't there when I had another full-time job.
Right.
So now it's like, hey, my job is to sell advertising now and to sell markets. I'll give you my honest opinion and hopefully people see that, right? Where I'm not just some guy who's just stroking egos and things like that in order, you know what I mean? In order to get,
yep.
you know, hey, if it wasn't for this product, I would have never shot this buck.
Right.
Like, I'll never say that shit. Right.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know. It just, I don't even know where we were going with that.
Just I have no clue, man.
right from the gate, just out to space.
I was going to say, it sounds like we're both a little, I don't know, we got to get some shit off our chest here.
All right. Right? So.
That's funny, man.
And so, gear, right? Mm-hmm. I want to talk a little bit about gear within the hunting industry. And I don't know why this popped up into my head when we were just having this little discussion. But so here's the deal. I have, you know, like back in the day, there used to be brand A sold tree stands, brand B sold trail cameras, brand, you know, C sold a safety harness, whatever the case is, you name a product, you put it in there. But then what you started to see is people or these businesses stop focusing on one thing. And then now they're trying to get more SKUs and they're trying to get like, okay, we have tree stands and trail cameras. We have trail cameras and safety harnesses, or now we have arrows and broadheads or whatever the case is. Have you seen, in your opinion, like once we started to go into competitive SKUs, we'll just call it that, have you seen a quality dip in these products when a company starts focusing on their bread and butter?
I would say so. Yeah. I think it's really difficult for people. I mean, kind of circling back to like the, you know, the personal brand and that slice getting thinner and thinner. Like, I think we've reached a point where, like you said, it's no longer company A makes kick-ass tree stands and company B makes awesome trail cameras and stuff like that. And obviously there is, you know, always three or so big names and stuff like that. And there still are in a lot of different spaces. But when it's like the tree stand company starts making, I don't know, trail cams, or the tree stand company starts making arrows like that, I think everyone's, for whatever reason, like trying to get into the archery space right now and like make their own. But even if it's like wraps or like stuff that's not, I don't know. I shoot $9 arrows, so I'm not going to like bash the guy who shoots a $60 arrow or anything like that. Because, you know, I just don't know that much and I don't have the brain space to dive down that rabbit hole. But like, I don't know. It's like, are you really making that much more money with branded arrow wraps or branded fletchings or whatever it may be? So, I mean, that's a roundabout way to say, like, I think yes, because companies are going to start spreading themselves too thin. And I think those SKUs are going to reach a point where they make enough average to below average products with their name on them that they're going to start to associate themselves negatively in the minds of consumers.
Yeah, that's a great point because I've seen it firsthand, right? You got the, and this is no dig on any of these companies, but like you have the big holding companies, right? They own like six or seven products or additional companies. But man, I've seen it once the owner sells the product to a bigger corporation, maybe he stays on or maybe he doesn't. He stays on, he tries to implement the same quality expectations and run the business the same. But when he sold it, he gave up like the decision making because they bought it to try to get more money. And how do you get more money? You combine resources like marketing budget, you combine resources like, I don't know, sales associates. So you're just not selling a rest, you're selling a rest and arrows and broadheads or whatever the case is. And now these salesmen are selling more products within the company. Your catalogs are getting bigger. I guess the benefit for the end, like the mom and pop retail store, is they get a pick with the offerings, right? And maybe there's benefits to that, but maybe there's not. But I feel like the passion behind the product goes down, the quality goes down, because the guy who had the most skin in the game, he said, I'm going to take advantage of this someone wanting to buy it for a higher end. And now I'm outie. Cause I, you know, I'm out, but it's hard for me to stay with that brand when that guy dips, because that guy was part of the reason why I bought that product in the first place.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, from the standpoint of the guy,
yeah,
they, I think, I mean, that's why a lot of us start businesses and stuff, right? Is you want to be able to support yourself. And then the opportunity comes along that you can sell the thing. Awesome. Because you can probably set yourself up pretty well for the future, right? And so then the focus goes towards that. But then I feel like I've seen so many guys who they sell the company and they, like you said, they want to have the same hand in things that they did prior, but they just don't anymore. It's not in the contract. It's not how that works. And they don't have the lateral movement that they used to where they could, oh, well, we can have excellent customer service if I just take care of this real quick because somebody I ran into somebody on the street rather than having to jump through three levels of corporate crap to just fix something, right?
Yeah. I feel like, and I don't know why I'm feeling so negative today, but I feel like a lot of that is gone, right? Where one of the favorite rests that I ever shot, I could call the company, the owner would answer, and I'd be like, hey, I got this issue. And he would either solve it for me, or the one time he just was like, yeah, it sounds like something happened to it. Maybe you dropped it. Maybe it got caught up. Maybe some sand or something got into it. I'm just going to send you a new one. And, you know, for the end, financially, is that a good thing to just start sending people products for free? No, it's probably not. But I'll tell you what, that end user who gets a free product because the owner took care of them is going to be closer to a lifelong brand loyal consumer than anybody else.
Right. Yeah. So, absolutely.
I don't know, man.
I think customer service, like you said, is what differentiates and like keeps those companies at the top is if something does go wrong, even if it's, you know, not the owner that you're speaking to on the phone. But, you know, I think of like one time I shot a turkey one morning and I got excited and I set my binos on the roof of my car and was like, I'll remember when I get back in the car. And then I took off and I heard and I looked back and watched my binos roll off in my rear view and explode down the highway. Luckily, I was like 10 minutes from the Vortex headquarters. So I brought, you know, all the pieces that I could gather in there. And they were like, oh, yeah, we'll give you a new pair. Just sign this form and what model it was. And I walked out with a new pair in 20 minutes, you know, like stuff like that where.
Yeah. Well, I'll say
you
this.
Feel valued.
Like those types of brands who are big enough to do that.
Yeah.
Right. Like Vortex. I mean, that's a win. That VIP warranty for Vortex Optics is it's almost industry standard in the optics game now. Like if you don't have that, why would I buy a pair of optics from anybody else other than Vortex? Because I know that if I break it or if it doesn't work, I'm going to get a product that is either fixed or brand new.
Yep.
Right. And so smaller mom and pop type operations that's, you know, sell like a one SKU, two SKU product line, they probably can't afford to do that unless it's like, if it was really the fault of the product and not the end user, I can see that. But, I have noticed that there are brands like, it's a shame to see them go, but Exodus trail cameras.
Yeah.
Right. They had a 5-year warranty on their trail cameras, which is ridiculous. Cause most guys, you know, I've had a lot of trail cameras throughout my life. And that has been like right around the time that 3-year mark is when they start falling apart, and for them to go 2 years longer than that, and then guarantee you a trail camera or a discounted trail camera, when it's all said and done, man, that was huge.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm kicking myself for never dipping into the Exodus, realm, I guess, but no, you're absolutely right. Like that 3-year mark is when the squirrels get after them. I mean, I took the inverse approach and I just started buying $30 Tascos that I was like, eh, whatever. If it gets mauled by squirrels.
How long did they last for you?
I'll probably get like another 6 months out of one of them, but like the lash is hanging on by a thread and I bought that last year. So I would say like actual field use, like a grand total of like 8 months, but
yeah, it just depends. Right. So I feel and I have no idea, like, I don't want to necessarily say anything political here, but I'm kind of curious how these new tariffs are going to affect the hunting industry, right? Mm-hmm. Because the hunting industry, there is a lot of overseas manufactured products within the hunting industry. Trail cameras, majority of broadheads, unless they're made in the United States, like arrows, like unless there is a specific product made or portion of that product made in the United States, like I'm kind of curious how those tariffs are going to affect the price of hunting goods. And you know what I mean? So
yeah, definitely. Well, especially as more technology enters in space and all that, you've got more, I don't know where Garmin makes their stuff, but, you know, the range finding bow sights and stuff like that. And like, we're seeing more and more thermal stuff come onto the scene for predator hunting and all that kind of stuff. Like, yeah. I think we're all going to find out really quickly where our stuff's actually coming from. And I don't know. Hopefully it's not too big a pill to swallow.
Have you noticed, like, even the Chinese made stuff from, you know, the foreign made stuff from back in the day seemed to be okay quality, right? There was a period of time where all these people were like, if it's made anywhere other than the United States, it's going to be junk. And I would agree with that. But then something happened in the manufacturing world, and I'm talking about hunting products specifically, where foreign made products were starting to improve in quality, right? Mm-hmm. But now it would be hard to say, ask a manufacturer and try to get a straight answer from them. Like, hey, are your products higher quality now than they were 5-10 years ago? There's no way that they would answer that question probably honestly, right?
Right.
But I feel, and this is just a gut based off of all of my, workings within the industry, looking at the products on a, handling products and things like that. Like, I just feel like some of those products, unless they're a standalone brand or unless they're made in America, everything else, the quality just seems to be kind of slipping again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know what the root cause of that would even be either.
I'm guessing money. I'm guessing money. Just like, we got to, in order for this business to survive, we have to cut costs somewhere. And we have to, if technology is too expensive, we have to not put that technology into our products unless we can afford it, So I don't know, man. It just gets to a point where I at this point, I do less tinkering with my gear and more staying the same product every single year because it works. Like, the boots that I've had 3 pair of the same exact boots now.
What
because
boots?
I've Crispy Thors.
Okay. Yeah.
And so it's the same exact boot I've had for 3 years. Why? Because I love that boot. They last forever, and I don't feel like I need to change that, nor do I want to take the risk changing it.
Yeah.
I don't know. Do you mess around with trying to find different products every year, or do you stay consistent with certain brands and products?
I messed around while I was getting into stuff, right? Because I think everybody kind of Frankensteins that first kit together with whatever is available to them, whatever they can afford. This year, I, thanks to some great partners and everything, was able to kind of consolidate stuff. And so I'm feeling good. I will say I think in most cases, it's a lot easier. Like, if you're going to buy a stand and sticks, buy the pair from the same company because they're just going to interface a little bit better. But I mean, I at this point, it takes up too much bandwidth for me to continuously tinker with a different bow sight, a different arrow setup, and a different, whatever and stuff. I'll make big adjustments. If I'm going to make like last year, I got a new bow and I was like, okay, that's my big adjustment, through the same sight, got arrows to, work with it appropriately and everything, and felt really good about it, but like still shot the same release. I wasn't messing around with the thumb button or anything like that. And I don't know. I think most people too, over the last 5 years or so, got kind of exhausted with the just the sheer number of options that are out there and the constant innovation. And it's cool stuff. Like, I mean, we've taken, I think the last 5 years, leaps and bounds from where we were at in terms of the innovation, the materials we use, and you know, how much more like tactical a lot of gear actually is. Mm-hmm. But at this point, I mean, I think from 2024 to 2025, are we really going to see that big of a jump?
Yeah.
Find something that feels good and works for you and let it rip. Well,
we talk about innovation a lot with bows, compound bows, and on paper, they all look the same, right? Just, I mean, maybe the axle to axle, the trend in axle to axle, goes up or down. The trend on, you know, like poundage, what's popular, you know, what the riser's made out of and, you know, the, everything on paper, but, so it's a lot more feel it, but it is funny how certain people will go on a different, like for me, I have realized that I like longer axle to axle bows, like 32, 33 inch. That's my wheelhouse. I love that, that number. And it's something that I'm going to stick with. But what's crazy is when the whole market moves to a shorter axle to axle, man, there was a time where I was shooting a 29 inch axle to axle bow.
Holy smoke.
I don't know why I was doing it, because maybe because that's what these brands were offering at the time. And instead of saying, well, I like it longer, I went ahead and I was like shooting a 29 inch axle to axle. And I was like, at the end of that year, I was like, why am I doing this? It goes against everything that I like.
Yeah. Have you talked to Nate Sellers about this?
The marketing of products?
Not necessarily marketing of products, but just like the trend specifically in bows.
No,
I asked him
not.
About that when I spoke with him, and he was basically saying the same kind of thing like you are, in that 30 axle to axle, that 29 or whatever it may be, they build that bow and figure, like, it's, I don't know, take whatever brand you want. They built that 29 ATA bow back in 2017 or something. And then the next year they had the bow after that and the bow after that. And there's like new models coming out every single year. Mm-hmm. All the while they're innovating on that 30 ATA bow or that 29 ATA bow to launch in 5 years. And so it's like all of a sudden you've got, okay, the 29 and then a 33 and then, a 35 and then a 30 again or whatever. And then 5 years later, boom, let's relaunch that, whatever that smaller chassis bow was that we've been working on innovating for the last 5 years. And I think people miss that and they treat it as like, oh, well, this is the new bow that came out. Awesome. I'm going to dive on that, because this, if it's the new bow for 2025 or 2026, like it's got to be the latest and greatest, right? Not knowing that it's just a spin-off of whatever the
previous
5 year. Yeah.
And what's also crazy is we'll just stick with axle to axle here is imagine the company pushing a 30 inch axle to axle while building a 34 inch axle to axle bow. Right.
Yeah.
And I understand that every body type is different, right? Some people like short, some people like long, some people like short brace heights, some people like longer brace heights, and so forth and so on about every statistic about a compound bow. But it's just strange where it's like, are they influencing the market, or is the end user influencing what they're building? Right. Mm-hmm. And so it's one of those things where it's like, am I really in control, or am I subconsciously buying said product because it's the only thing that's currently new being offered?
Yeah. No, 100%. Because I think we all find ourselves like, I've had this bow for quite a while. Maybe next year I'll get a new one or something. And then we naturally want that newest bow. Dude, if archery companies made the story of each like bow line easier to follow, and say it was the 30 version one And then 5 years later, there was the 30 version too. We'd all be like, oh, cool. It's just a souped up version of that bow from 5 years ago, rather than playing the guessing game of like,
right.
Well, I don't know what, you know, the alpha is, or the, you know, whatever, throw whatever name you want on there that,
right.
You know, I think if people knew what was actually going on, archery would be struggling a lot more than they are.
I don't know.
Not that I want that, but.
Right. Right. But I always thought it would be cool to be the guy who names the bows. Right. And so I was talking, I forget what brand I was talking to. I'm like, how do you come up with the names? And I think one of them was just like, they just sit around and say names until something cool pops up. Right. There's not really any like reasoning behind the full throttle versus the, you know, whatever the, you know, you just entered in there, but it doesn't mean anything. Right.
Right.
I feel like it would be sweet to just come up with some really dumbass names. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I'm with you, man. And like, try and figure out, like, I don't know, like I'll throw Matthews under the bus, whatever, like the VX3 or the VXR, like whatever, it like the bow is or whatever. Like, I think all of us subconsciously are like, that's gotta be an acronym for something badass.
Something.
And I don't know what it is, but
I've just been influenced. Right.
Right. Exactly. Right.
And that's a little note I had making down, you know, down here. So for me, if I want to compare influencers to owners, and maybe founders of brands, right?
Mm-hmm.
So let's say if I was the owner of the product and I was coming to you and I was telling you everything about this product, and how I put a lot of blood, sweat, and tears into it. And the reason I did this was because of this and this because of this. Or you had a different version of Dan Johnson, who is a podcaster. I hate the word influencer, but I guess you can call me whatever you want. Podcaster, hunting personality, you know, you name one of them and you got them all, right? Mm-hmm. And so who would you rather hear from when it comes to products? Would you rather hear from an influencer or the owner of the company?
Dude, that's a great question. I feel like you'll get a straighter answer on. Ooh, that's tough, dude. I think you'll get a straighter answer on performance and like in the field use from the influencer who's actually
using it.
But at the same time, they're getting paid to give a good review, right?
Mm-hmm,
so,
right.
I don't know, dude. I think if you want to know the why behind something is good, you go to the owner. If you want just an off the shelf, you know, hey, what'd you think of this kind of thing?
Yeah.
Go with the influencer. I don't know. That's a really good question.
I think a lot of times it depends on who the owner is, right? Let's take, for example, the DeQuistos, right? We know the owner of that company is a hardcore, serious, they're deer junkies, right? So of course I'm going to listen to what they have to say about their product because they are the ones who are using their products, and they designed their products because there was something there that they didn't like about the rest of the market, right? At least that's how it was when, you know, Andre originally introduced Lone Wolf, you know, back in the 90s.
Yeah.
You know, and then you have some of these other people who, an influencer, let's say, or a personality who is actually really good at hunting, who actually has a ton of experience behind whatever product it is, and maybe they had involvement in it. But I think it becomes necessary almost to have guys like us talk about real world situations as opposed to the owner who, like, the only reason there's marketing is because some of these owners are so focused and they go way over the detail that they need to, and they're not very good at explaining the real world uses. That's when the marketing guy steps in, and the marketing team usually finds someone within the space who knows what they're talking about to continue to talk about that product. But I personally think it's okay if the owner of the company is bland and boring. that's just who he is from a personality standpoint. I'm able to look through that shit and say, dude, you still got a badass product. You may be, you may not be able to sell it that well. Like, what am I looking for? Am I looking for someone to sell me something, or am I looking to go buy something that I need? And the end user should be able to weed through what is bullshit and what is real in order for them to find the product that fits them best.
Right. 100%. I think, when you're able to see, you know, you use the example of like the DeQuistos and Lone Wolf and stuff like that. When you're able to see plain as day that these guys are using their stuff on a daily basis, every single time they go out, and they're able to actually like give you a why between, oh yeah, we shaved this, I don't know, this thing, we added a hook here for this reason, and it needs to be here because when your hand is on this stick or you're setting up your stand, you need, like, you're just naturally grabbing the stand here and stuff like that. And you can figure that kind of stuff out. I think, like, if you find like that crossroads of influencer and brand where maybe you've got like a, you know, the whoever series line of tree stands or turkey calls or something like that or whatever, where it's like these guys have had an influence on the actual build of things. I think that just builds trust even further, because then it's kind of, you get the forward facing along with the innovation kind of behind the scenes, like technical product development type stuff as well.
Yeah. I've seen, and obviously it's a branding opportunity across, you know, promotional branding opportunity for both brands to get excited about, you know, a new product. And they probably both have some kind of maybe financial skin in the game. Mm-hmm. But one company that I've seen do that is like the Hunting Public.
Yeah.
And
totally.
They have worked with brands to come up with new products that they really like. I guess the one would be like the turkey vest for tethered, or maybe some saddle, you know, some saddle adjustments made, or different adjustments for, you know, the hardcore serious, you know, run and gun guy out there. And so I've seen that work, and I've seen those different versions of those products. And, you know, so far what I've seen out of that camp specifically has been a benefit to the end user.
Definitely. Yeah, absolutely. I think, as long as you don't find yourself in that camp of, I don't know, and this might be a good question to throw in there too. If you're somebody who's new and trying to like just get into this for the first time, do you gravitate towards that like beginner package or whatever, or do you go for that cream of the crop? Are you going to see the benefits of all this innovation going in? Like, are you going to just pick it up that much quicker if you've never done this before, or if you get out two weekends a year or something and you don't necessarily have the reps behind how you're using the gear and everything?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a great question. I think that if you're brand new to this and you're looking for new equipment and you don't, the first thing I would do is go to a friend who is already hunting, or, there's been a couple instances where, man, like, a friend of my wife or an acquaintance, let's say our kids go to the same school. I've had people who don't hunt know that I hunt, so they come up to me asking me general hunting questions. And so I talk to them, you know, I answer those questions. But if you're brand new and don't have, I wouldn't go necessarily to a store per se. I would first off go to a buddy and just be like, hey, like, If I had a friend that came up to me and said, Dan, I need some camo, or like, what camo should I buy? I would go, do you see that pile of clothes right there in my attic here? You can take all of it. You can take whatever you want out of this pile. You can have it. And that's where I would start. Mm-hmm. I would go, totally. I would ask friends if they had any extra stuff. I would go to garage sales. I'd go to Facebook Marketplace. I would ask buddies, you know, for advice about what to purchase. And I think at the end of the day, the influencers, the messaging from the brand themselves are important. But I think that comes, and this is my opinion, comes later down the line. When you have more of an established idea of what benefits the gear brings you.
Yeah, Totally.
If any of that makes sense. So
yeah, no, absolutely. I agree.
Yeah, but that's a great question. New people, I wouldn't even go, I would go somewhere else other than listening to guys like me talk. I would go to your buddies or known hunters, and because it depends on who you ask, right? Like yep. My uncle, the dude wears a little bit of camo, but he's like jeans. I think he just shot a 180 this year in a coat he's probably had for how, like, God knows how many years, probably 20 years. And then mm-hmm. A pair of like overalls, like a snowmobile suit basically. And he got the job done. So depends on who you ask. You're going to get a different, you know, different question. How many, you know, I would say how many days a week or a year? This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. Where are you going to hunt? Like, are you going to hunt in cold weather? Like, there's a whole bunch of questions that you have to ask before you go and make these purchases, but I feel like friends are better than the next step is. Start with your friends is what I'm getting.
Yeah, definitely. How important do you think, or I guess, how beneficial do you think getting wrapped up in, what gear do I need to add? Like at the end of a season, like getting wrapped up in like, well, what should I fix? What needs to get leveled up? What needs to like, whatever, how beneficial do you think that actually is versus just getting dialed in with what you've got? Obviously if something breaks or something's like Velcro right. and like making a ton of noise and you're mm-hmm. seeing like a direct correlation to failure, but
yeah,
I don't know.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
The first thing I would do is I would maybe at the beginning of the season, if you haven't done this already, talk a little bit about what your goals are for hunting, right? Are you a tree stand guy? Are you going to be doing tree stand and taking a trip out west where you're going to be doing some spot and stalk? Are you only spot and stalk? Are you going to be hunting in wide open range? Are you going to be hunting in timber? Like a lot of these things matter when you're picking out your gear and equipment, but I don't think it matters so much to where you can't train yourself to use that equipment in multiple scenarios. Mm-hmm. So I would say don't make it complicated. It doesn't yep. need to be complicated. It can be, I have this sight, I just need or rest or arrow or whatever the case is, and then get good first with everything that you already have. And then if there's something that is just a blatantly standing out and failing, then adjust that. But there's no need, and this is coming from a guy who makes his money trying to sell other people, like try to tell you to go to this brand's website and buy their product, right? You have to find what works for you, but I don't think you need to. I think you can get away with a five-year-old, six-year-old bow. I mean, my stepdad is killing deer with a bow that he's had since the 90s. Mm-hmm. So how am I supposed to tell that guy to change his bow? He's had success a lot with it, you know? So I don't know. I started this podcast to showcase a lot of the brands that were out there that maybe didn't necessarily get the attention that some of the bigger flagship brands got. Mm-hmm. And so, and that's why I like talking with smaller brands, especially on this podcast, and talking to end users on this podcast, like us, who, like, man, I'll tell you this, if a product really gets one chance with me, because if it costs me a deer or costs me an opportunity, then I will let the likelihood of me going back to that brand ever again is very slim.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this. Do you think that's because we now have so many options? Because I'm sitting here thinking, like, your uncle who's shooting that bow from the 90s, you know, there's some, like, thousands of hunters out there still who are shooting the old circular cam compound. You know, there's probably dudes out there still slinging aluminum arrow shafts and stuff like that, who don't listen to podcasts, who don't, you know, get the big catalog every single year, and who are just content with what they've been running since they were, you know, 20 or 30 or something like that.
Yeah.
Like,
I think a lot of it has to do with how much you immerse yourself in what you're doing, too. Right?
True.
If you're a weekend warrior and you get out 4 days a year to bow hunt, well, dude, you don't need any of that shit. First off, you don't need it, right? And if you were that guy that only hunted 4 days a year, but then made, like, I don't know how to make this sound less douchey, so I'm going to say it, but if you're the guy who's only hunting 4 times a year and spending thousands of dollars to make those 4 days a year
perfect,
like, I don't understand that. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, if I was only hunting 4 days a year, I'd be hunting in a pair of brown pants, a brown hooded sweatshirt. Right. I would probably have something to stay warm in cooler temps. You don't need a giant pair of boots to sit in a whitetail. Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
It just, if I was only hunting 4 times a year, I would be less concerned about my gear and more concerned about where I'm putting my tree stand, or where I'm putting my feet on the property to kill a deer.
Totally.
Now, if you're hunting 40 days a year, then what you need becomes completely different, mm-hmm. right? If you're going to do a backpack hunt in the middle of nowhere and you're going to be 3 miles from your truck, you need something completely different than a guy who walks 100 yards to his tree stand. So right. it depends on what your goal is and what hunt you're on. But even then, you don't even need the cream of the crop type stuff.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think too, you know, until you've got enough experience to really be able to tell the difference between two bows or two, I don't know. I use the, my mind jumps to like fly rods, right? I've got a guy that I've worked with in the past who dove into fly fishing, absolutely loves it, and just went off the rails, bought a dozen rods in like the first couple years of fly fishing. Mm-hmm. Bought all these rods, bought all this gear, bought all this awesome shit, but never put any time towards like actually getting out on the water outside of like going with guides and stuff, and like never went out there to actually figure it out himself and figure out his own thing. And so mm-hmm. one of the last times I worked with this guy, he hops out, gets geared up, rigs up 2 rods, has a third one waiting, fully rigged up in the car and everything. And I'm like, all right, you ready to go? I had a rod. He starts walking down towards the creek with 2 rods. I'm like, what are you doing? He's like, well, I just got this one as a backup in case I get hung up. I was like, well, dude, these are 2 totally different rods. Like, you've got 1 rod that's like an absolute cannon, like stiff, designed for, you know, like punching through wind. And you've got another one that's super soft and basically delicate, designed for, you know, super fine, you know, light, the pretty sexy, you know, slow motion, tiny little fly drop onto the, you know, a glassy surface pool sort of thing. And dude, you get you get hung up with this, with the broomstick, and then you switch gears and it's like you have to relearn how to cast all over again, because you're not just like getting
it's
good with that one
yeah.
rod, or getting good with the other rod or whatever, you know what I mean? And then trying to figure out, okay, how do I take this one rod and adapt it to a windy day, throwing different types of flies, different, you know, fishing in different ways and stuff. And it's like, you get paralysis by analysis after a while because you're trying to like fine tune the day and, you know, the conditions to whatever gear you've got available to you. And it's like the more gear you have available, the more thinking you're going to do about that rather than, okay, the fish is right there. How do I catch that fish?
Absolutely. You think too much about it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you shouldn't be thinking about your gear when you're out in the timber, right? Because if you're thinking about it, then it's like, maybe I don't have the right gear, right? Like the best example of that is boots, right? If you're on a hike and your feet are hurting or you're doing whatever you do out in the woods and your feet are just like, oh my God, my feet, I'm getting blisters or my feet are sore or stiff. Well, you got the wrong boots or the right wrong sock or something like that. So that tells me you probably need to reevaluate your boot setup. So,
yeah, I don't know, dude, it's tough until you do it yourself and you figure out how, you know, cause that same boot could be perfect for the next guy.
Yep.
But this other guy walks, he's got bad arches or something, or he walks like a little bit with more pressure on like the ball of his foot or something. And so he's got a huge blister or whatever it may be. I don't know. Like when I was shopping for bows and everything, the bow review process from however many different archery forums, however many different, you know, YouTube channels and stuff like that, everybody's saying different stuff and like, oh, this one's got kind of a lot of hand shock and stuff like that. I'm like, well, I'm shooting a 30 inch axle to axle 2012 Mission Riot, and this bow that I'm shooting right now, this, like, I got like a PSE, like the XF33 or whatever. I was like, I don't feel any hand shock in this thing right now. Sorry, I don't. Like, maybe you guys do, but I don't. This thing just feels like a Ferrari compared to what I've been shooting.
Oh, so. Dude, I can remember the first big major bow upgrade that I had in 2006. So I had, man, I was shooting a bow from the early 90s, right? It was like, I don't even remember what, I think it was a Bear maybe, or a Browning, or like a, could have been one of those brands. But then I went and I bought my own first brand new flagship bow, and the jump from my early 90s bow to my 2006 brand new Bowtech Tribute, I felt like I could kill anything at any distance. Like I was like, yep, 100 yarder, you know, like it just felt so different. And now when you change so many times, then that window of excitement kind of is smaller because the strides in technology aren't as big as they are for, like, you know, 15 years between bows. So
yeah, totally. Do you think there's going to be, I mean, I guess we're already kind of seeing it with like the resurgence of recurves and long bows and stuff like that, and guys shooting with those, but like, do you think we're ever going to see sort of like the nostalgia factor kick in on like those 90s bows, those 80s bows with, you know, the OG compounds and stuff?
I don't
like know. I think about like fly rods and everything, and you know, you grab an old 80s fly rod and you can kind of like feel the difference compared to now, and you're like, okay, well, this is like, I can appreciate the working with what they knew at the time of this fly rod. It feels goofy, it feels, you know, kind of funky, but it gets the job done. Like, do you think guys are going to start doing that with bows as well?
You mean like bow manufacturers trying to build bows with less technology in them, so you get a like a an old school feel?
Or I don't know, that's a, or like the market, good avenue,
like, or like my it becomes like a collection. Like guy's got a bow from the 90s and he's like, you know what, I'm gonna take it out for a spin to, you know, this year.
Yes, that
kind of stuff. Yeah maybe, you know, I got a bow downstairs. It's one of my favorite compound bows. I can't remember what year it was, but it was a Bowtech or a Prime Logic. And so it was the first Prime Logic that ever came, had limb stops on it. I really liked that. I liked the draw cycle on it. I liked everything about that bow. And then I upgraded a couple years later, and it just sits downstairs with a whisker biscuit on it. And really, I'm trying to wait for one of my kids to get big enough to use it, which I don't know if that'll ever happen. Because, you know, it's 70-pound bow, and so they're nowhere close to using it yet. Or if I want to take it out for a spin, sometime, but you know, or maybe do some small game hunting with it, or find a really cheap site to put on it and, you know, go shoot stumps. Maybe there's a market for that, a secondary market for that. But I feel if people are going to want to take a step in a different direction, this is what I'm thinking is like some trad shit.
Yeah.
Like just go right into trad. Mm-hmm. And they have, you know, like some trad bows that are, have really good technology in them, and they're not like a real traditional bow. They're like a medium type trad bow where they got a lot of technology in them, but they're not like the OG trad bow. And I feel like that is going to be my next step in archery, is going to going down the trad route.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So,
at least for whitetails.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I think that's kind of the thing that we've all kind of reached, is like, if we can bring some additional novelty to it of like, yeah, I shot, even if you're just hunting does trying to fill the freezer, like, yeah, I shot this deer with, you know, this funky, weird little trad bow sort of thing that, you know, I got. And, you know, I don't know. Cause
I'm that guy who, like, I feel like I'm heading the opposite direction. Mm-hmm. Like I'm in a point now where I have all the latest, greatest gear. I have the high powered bow. I have the high powered arrows. I take everything really serious as far as what I'm going to go do for my hunts and my goals. Honestly, I feel like I'm going to probably start pulling off of that and going back to like a very casual style of hunting that I'm assuming most people are doing. I'm going to be getting my kids involved more, probably start filling more tags and caring less about antler size and maturity. And I feel like my purchases on gear are going to reflect that that change in my approach to hunting.
Yeah, I like it. I'm going to circle back November 7th and ask you if you still feel that way.
The answer is going to be no, right? I will by then have upgraded on some shit that I do not need, right? And spent way too much money on gear. But, you know, I look back a lot of the gear or a lot of pictures, right? It's like, mm-hmm. Oh, there's a picture of me and a guy from 10 years ago, or there's a picture of me from when I was a kid, and none of it matched. None of it was pretty, but the memory was there for something. And I think at the end of the day, it's like when you're 80 years old and you say, hey, what was your favorite piece of hunting equipment? Nobody's going to care, but they can tell you, like, tell me your favorite day of hunting. Tell me who you were with, what you were doing, things like that. And you may not be able to even remember the things that aren't necessarily that important.
Right. Exactly. Well, yeah. You see that big buck walk into range and your eyes are focused on that. They're not focused on what sight I've got and what rest I've got and, you know, what my arrow build was for this, for this thing. I just care that I double lunged him and he piled up 40 yards later, you know?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And then he's currently sitting on a wall in my house.
Exactly. You know, I'm curious though, you know, you mentioned just like trying all this different gear and everything and like hunting through all of these different trends in the outdoor space and anything or in everything. Has there been anything that you've tried or like was popular, was a trend back in the day that you're like, in hindsight, you're like, that was so dumb or that just did not work at all?
Well, I don't want to say I tried it, but there was a time there in the early 2000s where there was a lot of gimmicky type products that were trying to be sold. Let's just say the first one that comes to mind is the Acorn Cruncher. Well, anybody who knows anything or has spent a serious amount of time in the woods will tell you that that product is not necessary, right? And so it kind of became a gimmick. And there's other products. Some might debate. Some are more gimmicky than others. But there was a time where there was a whole bunch of gimmick products. Now, I never really jumped into those gimmicky type products. I think the only one that I ever tried was there was a clip that you would clip on your pocket of your pants, and it was supposed to sound like two bucks fighting, rattling antlers. But it was like two spokes or gears. They looked like gears.
Yep.
And then they would magnet together, and then you'd pull them apart, and then you'd just like crack them together, and it sounded like two bucks fighting. I bought that. And other than that, I don't think I really fell victim to any other gimmicky products that I could think of. That was one of them. The other one would have been like ozone products, like Ozonics, which I initially thought were gimmicky, then started using it. And then I saw both in the field and out of the field applications for that. And I was like, holy cow. And now I use stuff like that. I use ozone every hunt.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh. Yep. That's one thing I haven't tried. I know guys who do, but I haven't tested it yet.
Now there's times it works better than other times, but, there's times where you get a deer downwind of you and you should be pegged, and they're just going, and they're just getting all that ozone right in their nose, and then they keep walking by or they turn around. But guess what they didn't do? They didn't bust you. They didn't blow. They didn't put their tail up. They didn't snort. They just kept walking. And then maybe another buck comes by later that night or in a couple minutes, and you get a shot at him because of it. So I don't know. I've had those types of scenarios play out with ozone products. And, I'm pretty happy with that product that I thought was gimmicky that now is a staple really of everything that I do.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I mean, I think there's definitely something to be said too, for not like you said, even if the deer doesn't come into range, at least as long as it doesn't wig out and then leave that adrenal scent on the ground. Cause we've all been there where that one doe stomps and gets a little weird. And then another deer comes walking down the trail, stops in the exact same spot, and is like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Something happened here recently that wasn't good. I'm scooting out of here.
I'm out of here. Yeah. And even ozone can come down and destroy. It really just destroys all odor, but it's not that some guy said, hey, try ozonics. I tried ozonics because of the science behind ozone, not necessarily the brand. That brand was the first brand that I really ever used. But outside of that, yeah, I mean, just straight up, just something that I thought was gimmicky, but it ended up turning. How about you? Any products like that for you?
No, dude. I mean, I was a big Scentwick guy back in my high school days.
Oh, did you the pine scent cone or the pine scent?
No. I'm talking about the pee bottles, man. Dude, I had pee bottles in my truck. I had pee bottles in my pockets. I had pee bottles in my, hunting bin, all sorts of junk like that, dude.
You didn't pee from the tree. You peed in a bottle.
Oh, no. I mean, like the little bottles of dope pee.
Oh, that's that, okay. Yeah.
No,
I gotcha.
Dude, I'll hang one out of a tree any day. That, yeah, the urine bottles. That was what I meant. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's funny. Dude, that was urine bottles are what taught me about thermals, because I hung one. I was like, well, I should just put it, cover up my scent. And I put it like basically off one of the D clips on the base of my stand. And it was just like, it'll be great. This way they won't smell me, or it'll push the hot doe scent further. And the sun got up and the thermal started rising straight up into me. All of a sudden I start like feeling sick, like nauseous. And like, I start dry heaving and I'm like, what's going on? Like, did I just not like, was there something wrong with the granola bar I ate that morning or something? And then I finally realized like, oh, I'm just like inhaling doe piss. And I had to climb down. I like, unclipped the thing, threw it down, but dude, I had to like sit at the bottom of the tree for like 10 minutes till I like my stomach settled again.
I'm such a dumbass when it comes to that stuff. Like, this is literally what I would do. I would take a handful of gravel and I would put it in my pocket. I would go to my tree stand with a bottle of like doe and estrus scent, and I would take a rock out, and then I would put a little bit on the rock, and then I would throw it in as hard as I can out in front of me, upwind of me. And I would do that like four or five times. And I'm like, okay, I have now just laid this awesome little area full of deer scent. And then every time I would bring my hand to my face, I would smell deer piss. Or like if I ate snacks, I'd smell it. So I literally would smell like deer piss all day long, like all day long. And when I was younger, I'd have a thing of deer piss and I'd put it in the fridge, but maybe I forgot to cut the cap. So when you would open it up the next morning or later that day, the whole fridge would smell like deer piss. And my mom would get mad at me for that.
I think the majority of people listening to this have done something similar to that. Dude, throwing the pee-soaked rocks is genius, though. That's
innovative. If you're
going to
call
me a genius
for that, yeah, I'll do that.
On paper, it works until, yeah.
Man, I used to do drag rags back in the day. You know what a drag rag is?
Yep.
So I'd tie something like a string to my boot or just drag it with me. Mm-hmm. And then on the end of that was a rock with a string around it with like, a piece of cloth, and then do that. And then my buddy, Sam Calora from Miss Dopey, here in Iowa, he was local, where I grew up, and he taught me how to do like this J hook to the stand. Now, if it works or not, I don't know. Like maybe I've had deer literally come with their nose down the exact same trail that I walked, sniffing and following that J hook into my stand. So I don't use it anymore, but in the past it has brought deer in, nothing gigantic or old or mature. I mean, some does, some bucks, but I don't know. It's just another strategy some guys use with scent
points. I would love to try that again and just see. See if it still holds true. Yeah.
Go back to, 20 years ago when we were starting it and try all the strategies and tactics that we started off with.
Yeah. I it would be interesting to see what sticks, right?
Yeah.
Because how much of it was like the trend just veered away from drag rags or, whatever it may be. And they were like, there's more money in this. We'll we'll market this as the latest and greatest sort of thing. I'll be curious to see, like, with synthetic scents now and like the whole mock scrape thing, do the urine bottles start to disappear off the shelves? And then suddenly everybody's buying blue ropes and tubs of synthetic stuff.
I don't know
how,
man,
quickly did the deer catch on.
Well, I'll tell you this, I didn't necessarily know how all this mock scrape nonsense was going to work for me, but I realized that you do it right, it's not nonsense. Like, it's less about getting a big buck to hit your and stay active on that scrape, and it's, for me, it's more about pairing it with a camera and getting inventory of the deer that are in the area. So I don't know. It can work. It can work both.
Yeah.
Both ways.
I don't know. I've talked to enough people over the last year or so that have had luck
with mock scrapes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I'm going to use them until for some reason it bites me in the ass, and I haven't had it bite me in the ass yet. So
do you see mature bucks showing up on camera, hitting those scrapes that you, all right, good to know.
Yep. And not necessarily, which is weird part, not necessarily in the timber, but on field edges is where I get more of the big buck scenario where they're actually using the mock scrape.
Yep.
In the timber, they'll smell it for some reason. They won't necessarily use it, but they'll come to investigate it and then keep moving. The ones on the field edges are where they become active with it, and they're engaging in the mock scrape. So that's just something little that I've noticed too.
Huh. I wonder if it's just a matter of, like when they're in their beds and in their, the thick areas where they feel secure, if they're much more reliant on their nose at that point, whereas like,
I don't know,
in an open field, they can't cover everything. So they have to hit that scrape. Whereas they could be 50 yards off it, 80 yards off of it downwind and just catch a whiff of it and be like, okay, I know that that's, so-and-so hit that scrape. I'm going to stay in this bedding area though. And then loop out after dark, whatever. That's interesting.
Yeah. I don't know, man. I wish I could think like a white-tailed deer, then I would kill more white-tailed deer.
Right.
White-tailed bucks.
Isn't it weird we haven't cracked the code yet?
No.
All this dog training stuff. We can understand like the psychology of all these animals except for the ones that we're trying to kill.
Right. Well, it would be sweet. Have you seen the movie The Beastmaster?
I have not, no.
Okay. Well, it's a movie from the 80s, and it's about this guy who can talk to animals, and he can let's say an eagle is flying in the air. He can transport his mind to the eagle so he can see what the eagle is seeing, right? So I think it would be sweet to transport my mind into a white-tailed buck and then see where he's at and then go kill him.
Dude, so that would be...
maybe Elon Musk and Neuralink, that Neuralink thing that he's maybe allow me to talk with animals.
Yeah, rather than a collaring study, we just do a microchip study.
And, a microchip study, yep.
Yeah, we try dropping that in. That'd be terrifying. God, either that or just do a bunch of shrooms. I don't know. But
on that note, my friend, that's where we end it before we start talking about drugs. So, hey, Pierce, man,
I'm really advocating for that. No.
Exactly. Wink, wink. Hey, Pierce, man, thanks for taking time to hop on the show and BS with me about gear for a little bit. If people want to find out more about Pierce and the Wisconsin Sportsman podcast, it's on the Sportsman's Empire Network. It's wherever podcasts can be downloaded. Absolute great conversations coming out of Pierce's podcast. So thanks, Pierce. Appreciate your time, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.